Hi, I'm Sam Kanduff, and this is Decoding Cultural Leadership. Welcome to Decoding Cultural Leadership. Culture, Society, Conversations, presented in association with Limelight. It's great to have you with us. If you're listening for the first time, thank you for finding us. If you're returning, welcome back. In this series of unfiltered conversations, we explore the intersection between culture and society and explore the meaning of the shifting expectations of leadership, cultural leadership in the 21st century. In each episode, we talk to some of the most influential organizational leaders, creators, policymakers, and thought leaders. And we explore their approach to shifting the dial in a complex, constantly changing world. We hope that you enjoy listening to this podcast as much as we enjoyed making it. We've learned a lot through these fascinating conversations, and there's so much more to come. So let's dive into today's episode, and together, let's decode cultural leadership. This week's guest is Borby Webster. I was thrilled to sit down with the trailblazing Borby Webster, the visionary founder of Perth Symphony Orchestra. From her days as an Oxford graduate to her time with Bond, one of the world's most renowned classical crossover groups, Borby's journey has been nothing short of remarkable. In this conversation, she shares her unwavering determination to break barriers and achieve her goals, no matter how many doors she has to knock on. Borby's passion for elevating culture to the forefront of economics and politics dialogue shine through as she discusses her vision for the transformative power of music to shift society. She also discusses her mission since stepping away from the Perth Symphony Orchestra in 2022, the groundbreaking organization she founded and nurtured. So join us as we explore the insights and experiences of a driven entrepreneur and cultural advocate who continues to make an impact through her practice of culture-driven change. Well, I'm so happy to welcome to Decoding Cultural Leadership today, the founder and former creative director and CEO of the Perth Symphony Orchestra, Borby Webster. Borby, welcome.
Hi, Sam. Lovely to be here.
We were just talking before. We've sort of, circled each other for a number of years and almost met on several occasions. And it's very, very nice to meet you in, we're not in person. You're in Perth. I'm in Melbourne, but we just missed each other last week here in Melbourne, but it's really fantastic to speak to you. So thank you for joining me.
Same. Love your championship of the whole arts, Sam. So yes, a pleasure to be here chatting.
Wonderful. And so much to talk about. And I think we were talking just before we started recording today and said we could probably talk for hours now. So I'll try and, together we can keep it kind of moving along. But, I want to sort of wind back to before Perth Symphony Orchestra days, and you had a fantastic start to your professional life. You were at Oxford. You were a champion rower. You were involved in so many, I think you've been described on many occasions as a high achiever, and you stepped into this group, this really interesting group, Bond, which is the sort of intersection of classical music and getting to popular audiences. Could you just talk a little bit about how that came about?
Of course. And look, we're all such a product of our very unique pathways in life, and that unique tapestry leads us to where we are today. And if someone had said to me that's going to be your life when I was a teenager, I would have probably run and hidden, actually. Just to pick you up on high achiever, I just think I'm a prolific doer, Sam. Yeah. Not a high achiever, a prolific doer, and some of that actually gets stuff done, so that's how I phrase it. Look, I was brought up in the most typical middle class English village way. I mean, if you think Vicar of Dibley, you're not far wrong. only with no one quite as funny as Dawn French. But my parents loved music. I loved music. Schools in England have music. We sung every morning because I went to a Church of England primary school. And so singing, and everyone got a recorder. God, poor teachers. So for me, I don't even remember learning to read music. So music was such a part of who I was. But within now, I see an unbelievable silo of this is English middle class music, Western making, and this is how you do it. And this is, and all of your teachers are putting you on a path of learning this and revering the great orchestras in London. And that's the path you're going to aim for. Mm. And of course, I didn't question that once. Why would I? That's what life is, and off you go. And we all accept a huge number of things about what life is and should be. at Oxford, I discovered that if I wanted to play the music that I wanted to play, as opposed to just turn up to every symphony orchestra going, and look, being at Oxford is like living on a film set. And of that, I think there's sort of 36 colleges or something, 25 have a symphony orchestra. You know, I mean, that's wow. Because music and education and, tradition go hand in hand in the UK. Mm. So you've got ridiculously gifted musicians at that uni. So again, just following this one trajectory. But if I wanted to play the music I wanted to play, I had to organize it. And I realized that I just had this prolific gift for doing stuff.
Yeah.
Or just prolifically doing stuff. And by the time I got to London, all of my radar was who needs something done, who needs something created, I'll make it happen. And I saw a poster, wanted two violins, violoncello, must be female, ring Rob. And I thought, if they're asking for female, it's bound to be a string quartet. And my female string quartet had already been playing on shows like Top of the Pops, which we all thought was hilarious.
Yeah.
Mining, semi-breves. You weren't even given any music to play. And you couldn't even hear any strings on the records. That was what was even more. We were miming to a sound that didn't exist, but no one in the public seemed to care. Already I'd kind of been part of this. Oh, actually, I can play my viola in that setting. I didn't think that I belonged on Top of the Pops. That's not my silo. But obviously, answering that advert for two violins, violoncello, I must be female, plonked me in a manufactured girl band that at the height of girl bands in the UK in the 1990s. And it was such a fascinating journey because, you know, we were being kind of prepared for the fact that people were going to say, you're not classical, mm-hmm. And all this kind of stuff. And the manager that we had, who was a public relations genius, played on this whole fact that, are we classical or not? And I was like, who cares?
Yeah.
Like, who? If we are great music and great musicians and we play well and people resonate, then that's the issue on the table here. But it was fascinating. I mean, you know, not for a second do I think we're playing classical music. We just happen to be playing contemporary music on classical instruments, in my view. But then what is classical and contemporary? I mean, hello. So suddenly all of the things that are all of the barriers and the walls and the silos and everything started crumbling for me when I started being able to question, okay, what is classical music? What is, why do we even need labels? Like, what is this world I'm part of? And actually, how far can the boundaries be pushed? So I think that set the tone for the rest of my life, really. Yeah.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, Duke Ellington famously said, you know, what is jazz? Well, there's only two types of music, good music and bad music.
I'm with them.
Absolutely. Yeah. We get sort of hung up on these genres and these different things and everything. And Bond, as you're saying, it was a real moment where that sort of that sound of like, classical crossover, I guess it was a sort of a genre for a period of time that sort of was starting, and Bond was at the forefront of that. So you must have had some great experiences with that band and must have taken you to some interesting spaces.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, God, just even recording. So being at Abbey Road and having the Royal Philharmonic as your backing band when your teacher's sitting in the section is quite, awesome, to for want of a better word. Even the playing, I think one of the things that really struck me, the first kind of performance we did was a showcase. And we were signed to Decca Records, which was sort of part of the Universal umbrella. And I think it was a Christmas party end of year. And you've got to remember, when you've played classically, your entire life is people going, wonderful. I mean, you feel that. It's lovely. And you can see people nodding and appreciating. At the showcase, everyone was like, I was just like, oh, my God. Like, that made you want to play. And it made us physical. And you can't just stand there and look concentrating when you've got someone bouncing at you. So you're then, you know, the energy, and suddenly I realized, my God, there's just this energy, and it's present in classical music, and it's so suppressed.
Yes.
It's all, and you really just want to, I've been to a Mahler symphony and a huge uproarious, and you just want to let you feel the same emotion as a rock concert for those of us who love classical music.
Yeah.
And suddenly for the first time, I realized that again, there was another rule that I'd never even noticed before, that people were not, both musicians and audiences were not allowed to be anything more than reserved. There were so many brilliant memories, formative experiences, meeting other famous musicians, and you'd just be in a studio and someone would stick their head in and they'd go, oh, it's Julio Iglesias. Nice to meet you, Mr. Iglesias. My mum has all your records. You know, I've seen lots of great stories from that.
Oh, it's incredible. And I don't want to go into my own anecdotes, but when I was working in London around that time as a pianist and playing at a lot of, you know, private parties and events and corporate stuff. And I did a gig, and it might have been after you left Bond. I'm not 100% sure, but it was the launch of the James Bond movie at the Barbican. The first one that Daniel Craig did and with Bond and Bond. And I remember all that, you know, the guys came out of the elevator just as I was sort of leaving. I'd done my bit and the band was coming on, and I was like, wow, this is something else. When you started looking at that vision of classical music and thinking about breaking down some of those barriers, did that kind of inform your vision for the Perth Symphony Orchestra? Was the inspiration as to one of the pillars as why you started that ensemble?
Look, it's way more organic than me suddenly waking up one night with a very clear picture. So, look, when I departed Bond, one of the things that had really frustrated me was that as a musician, I knew nothing about the world. Mm. And I didn't even know how the music got on my stand. I'm booked to play Handel's Messiah. I turn up, the music's on the stand. I don't even know who stand there. I sit there and I play that music. And I just realized, you know, a lot of time in Bond, I kept saying, who's paying? I knew someone was paying for the Royal Philharmonic. I sure as hell was poor as, you know, God, when you, being a post, because I studied postgrad at Royal College of Music in London, and anyone studying in London is absolutely poor. Yeah. And so it was just a case of me sort of going, first of all, I need to understand business. So my first thing in Australia when I got here in the year 2000 was to understand business, thinking, I know I need to do something in the music world, and I know I need to meld the woo-hoo-hoo with the Mala, and hadn't got a real clue what that looks like. Fast forward to 2007, I'd spent 7 years in Australia in the corporate world, climbing the ladder, doing an MBA, and a massive global show called The War of the Worlds, written by Jeff Wayne, which is an iconic double album, epically narrated by Richard Burton, programmatic piece of rock music. Now, obviously, as a classical musician, that programmatical thing where there are constant themes woven throughout music, riffs, I mean, it's rock music, but it's conceived classically. And it, for me, just this genius album. And I, through a sickie, sorry if my ex-boss is listening to this, to play in that show. And I sat there in a now non-existent venue in Perth with, you know, a 12-piece rhythm section. And I looked over and I knew several members from the band who were all rock legends who I'd met through Bond. Yeah. There was a 40-meter screen. There was a ginormous hologram. There were 13 trucks of gear. And I just thought, why do we not create stuff? Why do things visit here that are this big? Why is no one in Perth creating something like this? And if I did, how on earth would I do it? And I just thought, this is nuts, because we have the climate in Perth. We have beautiful open parks and spaces. In fact, you know, my ambition was just Perth at the time. I've got a bit more braver than that, and I'm looking to much bigger horizons now. But at the time, it was Perth needed something exceptional that could potentially be exported musically.
Yep.
And the first thing I thought was, well, there's no way that the WA Symphony Orchestra would do this kind of thing or create this kind of thing. They might say yes to being hired to play it, but they wouldn't take time out of their schedule, certainly back then. And look, maybe they would now. No, actually, I don't think it would be part of their remit or vision to do this, but to create mega engaging shows. So War of the Worlds has a 46-piece string section, which is as big as any symphony orchestra can get, basically. Mm-hmm. You don't have more than 50 players in any symphony orchestra on strings. So this was this huge, conceived, amazing production. And that one show sitting in there changed the course of my life when I thought, we have to create something like this. It has to, this appeal of this music and how it was conceived with the stories. And I thought, if we could create West Australian stories, if we could play massive symphonic music with stories, but in this multimedia kind of way, wouldn't that be extraordinary? Hadn't got a bloody clue how to do it, Sam, at all. You know, but that was a huge catalyst for me. So that was 2007. Mm-hmm. I started putting the idea for the orchestra together then, started putting the playlist together in 2009, still left my job at the end of 2007. I knew that point was past where I had to leave the corporate world and go back into music. It literally took until November 2011 for me to put the orchestra on a stage, for me to work out what it was, what it would play, where, how. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. Hardest thing I've ever done is working out the first concert and how to pay for it.
Because I mean, it's the complexity of the orchestra. I mean, as consumers, when we watch something on stage, we go, "Oh, isn't that wonderful?" But the actual complexity of putting something of that scale together is
my naivety. I mean, you know, I was head of business development for an engineering firm. I know. Before leaving, hats off to engineers, what extraordinary humans they are, and it's unbelievably creative, the process and design that goes into that. So, you know, really value the fact I had that national role in a major engineering firm. But by only doing the business development bit, yes, I'd sit in on exec meetings and have the financials presented in the IT, but I'm not there in those departments doing those things. And the same when you're an orchestral musician, you sit in a chair and you do your job and you do it dab well. That means I had not got a clue how stage setup was done, even how ordering of equipment, let alone the library, licensing of music, printing of music. Oh my gosh. I mean, just every element was completely new to me. And I had not realized how enormous a symphony orchestra's operations are, and how every single team has to be a high performance team within one entity that delivers a unified outcome towards a single purpose. And it, you know, that the lessons I've learned on not just creating teams, but how to connect teams to create a community that's focused on one goal. Yeah, it was the whole thing was bigger than Ben-Hur, Sam. Like, you know, I arrogantly thought I can play the viola in an orchestra. I know what it looks like.
Mm.
You just put some stands on a stage and some music on the stands and it will play. Absolutely not.
A lot more to it, yeah. And I'm really interested to get into your leadership approach and your leadership style. Just winding back to what you were saying before, you know, you didn't wake up with this kind of vision to develop audiences or to bring classical music to the masses. It wasn't about that. It sounds like for you, Bobby, it was more around a big concept, like seeing something thematically, conceptually, and you mentioned telling stories. Is that fair to say?
100%. So it was about, why are we not creating amazing content with Australian stories that resonate with the people on stage? Why are we always playing someone else's music from a country far away? And that's everyone, whether it's playing with Rod Stewart, you know, his music on stage, or playing Mahler. It's not us. And Australia has so many extraordinary stories to tell and composers to play and things. So it was always back then going, I really want to create something unique for this country that I'm in, because it's so extraordinary and the musicians I met were so gifted. I then did backfill it, Sam. Like, I've learned so many leadership lessons that I'd kind of read in books. So obviously when you're part of a corporate firm, you get sent away on a lot of retreats and leadership training. So a lot of the concepts I'd kind of learned and through my MBA. But I'd never really, when people kept talking about, oh, you've got to say what your values are. And I just thought these were just exercises, really. I couldn't ever understand how they really connected to the engine room of the company until I started Per Symphony. And then I realized that not just having the big vision of what we could be, but the why, really, why do we exist? And it wasn't, and it took me a couple of years to go, so why should this new company exist? And it wasn't until the why happened that everyone started going, but I think that too, so I'm going to help you. So yeah. It was amazing, the difference between getting really clear on what and why was then the sticky glue that helped me get the orchestra started.
Fantastic. And so if you were to crystallize that what and why, was it around telling those Australian stories or those Western Australian stories?
Yeah, the what was that we had to get a symphony orchestra out of the concert hall into the community to play stuff that the community could resonate with at the most. You know, community pride. This is me. I see, you know, when you're in a footy stadium and your team is playing and you might be in France watching Australia, but when an Australian, you know, again, sing, when they bring the music into that and you feel part of that team supporting them locally, it's your music, your culture, your identity. Mm. So, and music to me has always been so much more than a piece of music on a stage. It's been absolutely about humanity and connection, and feeling just that you matter, every single person.
Decoding Cultural Leadership is supported by Limelight, and the May 2024 issue of Limelight is now available online and in print. And as ever, it's packed with news, features, and reviews. This month's issue explores the power of Puccini and why his operas are so popular a century after his death. It takes a look at Umberto Clerici's rapid rise from cellist to chief conductor and the phenomenal Sarah Brightman's return to Australia in Sunset Boulevard. Limelight
Moonlight, Australia's dedicated music, arts and culture platform. Please head over to their website, limelight-arts.com.au, and find out how you can start accessing Limelight's excellent content today.
So, but it wasn't until I started saying, okay, but then why am I doing this? Why me and why WA? And it boiled down to two really clear reasons was that one, so many of my friends in WA were literally going, I wouldn't be seen dead in the concert hall, Bawby. No way am I going to go and watch a symphony orchestra. And the second, so I was like, we have to change that. And when you quiz people and you're saying, so hang on, you know, during Lord of the Rings, there's a battle scene, there's no dialogues, just galloping horses and masses music. You turn that off and you put Britney Spears on because it's not your thing. And people are like, no, 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 I love that. And I'm like, okay, so you love orchestral music. You understand how it can make you feel. But what we're currently doing with it and how we're presenting it is not cutting the mustard. So let's get it out of the concert hall into the community and start programming it in a way that does matter to you. And then the second thing was that I was 24 when I got here and every other gifted musician that I was playing with was on a plane out of here. I was like, stop, don't go. You know, and look, we've got the WA Symphony Orchestra is an incredibly brilliant orchestra and, you know, it attracts world-class talent, but there's a job a year. For, you know, an instrumentalist, if you're a flautist, there's a job every 10 years. That's not going to keep gifted musicians in Western Australia. And I kept thinking, but if no one wants to go and see Wazzo in its current form, and with all due respect, there was obviously a demographic that did back then, but a huge percent of the population that didn't, which I can't understand, but I understood. And then there's no one else left for me to do anything with. I had to do something about this. So it was like, okay, I can't just create a small ensemble or something cool in it. I've got to just go mass. We've got to create a big rocking beast that can show people what orchestral music does. So yeah, so we existed to get music out of the concert hall into the community where people live, and to retain West Australian talent and give West Australians work. They were the two, and that motivated a lot of people to support us going, those aims are, were, and then I said, and then overarchingly, the thing that connects an entire state, you know, the reason that you love watching a movie is the music soundtrack. We have to be creating a music soundtrack for our state and then eventually, you know, beyond. So,
I mean, you articulate such a clear vision there and like the what and the why is so clear and you can see it on every level how artistically that's, you know, fulfilling and also but connecting in terms of community, but also providing a pipeline and work for musicians as well. And I mean, I wonder just on your observations of other orchestras and other cultural institutions, do you think they don't necessarily have that clarity about their role and their purpose?
They do, but whether it's the right one, Sam, is what I question. That to have a purpose to simply enrich lives or to play extraordinary music and all of that, and that they are doing that, they are fulfilling those missions, but sometimes I wonder if that's so broad. I mean, I don't know a symphony orchestra that isn't trying to touch the human spirit or enrich humanity, or and it's like, but what about me, you know, like how to make it resonate with the person, you know? So we're all about, I want to come and play for you where you live and play things that you love, that's it. And people are like, what, you'll bring an orchestra for me, like what, you know? The first time we played for a suburb called Armidale, and which I think is a beautiful suburb, and it's a very old per suburb, and it's got families that go back years and years, and a big Indigenous population, rich storytelling and beautiful surrounds. It's in the southeast corner of Perth. But some would say that it has a different kind of reputation, and I never care about that stuff. And we took the symphony orchestra there due to a local hero called John Christmas, who said he spent 50 years trying to bring an orchestra to Armidale. And the feedback afterwards was made me so proud that a symphony orchestra would come here, or, oh, how you know, thrilled are we that a symphony orchestra would come to us. And I'm like, whoa, of course we will. Like, why wouldn't we? Like, yeah, you know, but the pride that brings of, wow, bring this beast of collective talent to us. So Sam, I really feel that, you know, I come back to, are these vision, mission, purpose, values, exercises that every company seems to do meaningful? Well, not if they're cerebral or broad. If it's about people that you are really trying to connect with, it's about the individual, it's about really understanding how is it going to be translated into something personal for someone, then you're on your way, in my view.
Yeah. And it's so clear. I mean, it makes so much sense when you sort of express it that way. And I mean, in my research that I've been doing about orchestras and cultural leadership, and, you know, not to say that everyone's getting it wrong, but there seems to be often this sort of, there's these inherent tensions in symphony orchestras, like artistic versus non-artistic objectives. This is always battling, but then that seems to sort of confuse when there's a discussion about what is our role, what is our purpose. It's very difficult to come up with, you know, one particular answer, but you've had a very clear vision about bringing that to the community, bringing that to people.
Yeah, the personal mission was distilled by my partner. And we came up with a lot of hashtags when we first started. It was going to be personal hashtag something, you know, cool. And he literally was like, just music for everyone.
Yeah.
That's it. And like, we went round and round and we tried to come up with different things. Like, why do we exist? What are we here to do? And it was like music for everyone, with the emphasis on everyone. And, you know, and it was like, okay, so if we're music for people in high-vis vests and steel cap boots, what does that look like? If we're music for someone wearing pearls and driving a Mercedes Benz, then what does that look like? You know, we are music for everyone. And that, I mean, in some ways gave us limitless possibilities, but instantly it was so straightforward that everyone could get it.
Yeah.
Like, well, I'm everyone, so surely there's got to be something for me. So, yeah, and we made sure that happened. Yeah.
Good and clear, yeah. And you should know too that, I mean, you started this as a private commercial venture. You know, you didn't, I believe you had limited, if not any, public funding to start with. Is that right?
Yeah, look, it was just my savings. So, thankfully, having worked for an engineering firm, for a couple of years, and literally when you're on the move and I was traveling all the time, I had no time to spend anything that I earned. So I'd banked up, a chunk of money and basically said, right, that's it. So that's what's going to back me. And the first sponsorship we got from AHG, which is an automotive group, that paid my first assistant. That was her salary. So for 5 years, I was still gigging, playing viola at every wedding, bar mitzvah and funeral I could possibly lay my hands on, and doing a bit of lecturing and just freelancing in order to support myself to be able to work. So initially every bit of money from any concert or any performance purely went on paying musicians, crew, and, you know, the hard costs to deliver every concert. It took 5 years for me to even earn a salary. And that was literally when we started saying, we've got to put a 15% margin on everything into the kitty that could then build up enough to pay me. Look, I don't think we got our first government funding until 2019.
Yeah.
Really. At which point we were turning over 2 million. And we got a $100,000 grant, which was fantastic, but by no means a game changer. It was certainly not going to be an investment that would catapult us into a new horizon, which is what I'd hoped. Because, you know, that was one of the hard things. You know, I started it as a proprietary limited company because of speed. And I'm someone who wants to work at speed. I want to be agile. And if you've constantly got to be asking the board of directors, can we take this risk? If you've constantly got to be applying for funding that closes in 3 months, that gets judged in 7 months for grants starting in 2025. I'm like, if we want to tell genuine stories and reflect what's going on in the world right now, you know, we need to be nimble and quick and just go. And we've done a lot of those. And, you know, we've got a concert up and going at 7 weeks. 7 weeks, the idea. 5 weeks, everything's commissioned and announced, and we've delivered it. All new charts written, you know, everything done in 7 weeks. And you could never, you know, it was just almost impossible to do that if you were relying on funding. So I knew that we needed to have a much more commercial, entrepreneurial, Silicon Valley-esque mindset, which you'd never normally put in the same words as a symphony orchestra. No. But what happened was that people who really saw the value in what we were doing wanted tax deductible donations if they're going to invest a big chunk of philanthropy in us. And the philanthropy came before the funding by a long shot.
Right.
So I made that really, I still don't know if it was the right decision. But it's interesting because so many bodies won't fund you if you're not a not-for-profit.
Yes.
Certain grants doesn't make sense to me, because then you have to sacrifice your ability to generate revenue and get investment and grow. And like any company, a symphony orchestra has periods where it wants to do something ambitious. And to do that, we need investment. And where do you get that from?
Precisely. When
funding cycles are 4 years. They don't want to fund commercial investment, and yet commercial investment can help sustain you. So in a way, look, the whole system doesn't work. But don't get me started on that. All of us at Parts know that. And look, that's part of you know, jumping to the end of the story, why I wanted to move on and hand over this incredible, amazing thing that's dear to me, is because there are some bigger problems that I will hope to be part of the solution to.
I'm really looking forward to hearing your thoughts on those too. That's wonderful. But the agility that you talk about is certainly something that we would never associate with, you know, the traditional classical symphony orchestra structure. They work on these, you know, very long booking periods and long concert periods and long programming cycles. And it's, everything's looking ahead. And even, I would say, even probably in the commercial theater world, you know, we sort of look at longer cycles. So you were really creating something very, unique and innovative with PSO, and you did sort of, as you said, seven weeks. And I'm interested in some of that programming that you did, Bobby. You were telling those Western Australian stories. I know this wonderful work that you did. The artist was it C.Y. O'Connor, telling that amazing story. Can you just talk a little bit about how that particular production came together?
Oh, look, my inspiration just comes from all over the shop, and the C.Y. O'Connor story came about because I was given a novel by a West Australian author, Amanda Curtin, and it was Kathleen O'Connor of Paris. And I read this beautiful story about the daughter of C.Y. O'Connor. Now, for anyone not in Western Australia, he's very much a local hero here. C.Y. O'Connor is the engineer that designed things like Fremantle Harbour. I mean, the way I understand it, he was chief engineer and pretty much designed all of Perth and all the bridges and all everything. But he also designed the Kalgoorlie Boulder pipeline, which was getting water from Perth out to the goldfields, which, you know, is this ridiculously long 7-hour drive east into the desert. And that there's a fabled story that when they turned on the water after 3 days, nothing was coming through, and he was so ridiculed that he committed suicide. That isn't actually the truth. He knew that it would take 5 days or something for the water to travel through the pipe. That's just how long water takes chugging along to go, you know, several hundred kilometers. But his daughter, what a contrast. I mean, like, her father was this esteemed engineer. They obviously lived in society Perth. She hated all of it and ran away and lived in an attic in Paris and painted. And her artwork is extraordinary. It's all over Australia. It's worth a fortune now. You know, she hung out in Paris with Picasso and Dali and got moved to London in the war, then got sent to the West Country. There's a story about her, which was she was so poor her entire life. Occasionally money would get sent across to her to prop her up. Eventually, her family insisted she came home in her later years. And when she got to Perth, they basically wanted to tax, saying that she's bought all these artworks and she's going to sell them and it's their business products and they all have to be taxed. And she had no money. So she threw the majority of the collection into Fremantle Harbour. You know, only a small handful of her works remain. And so this story captivated me. And I kept thinking, yet again, another artistic person that had to leave Perth because, you know, forgive me, but a huge percentage of Australian culture is, oh my God, singing, cringing. Oh, you know, all that la-di-da arty stuff is not consistent with what our cultural norms are of being a good Aussie bloke and being outdoorsy and fit and sporting. That culture is kind of really cringy. And look, I know that's not for everybody, but trust me, it's still very alive and well. And yet here was this artist that if she'd stayed in Western Australia, and she's so gifted, you know, if she was a football player, she should have a statue, you know, in Forest Place, her impact on the art in Australia and, you know, her status. So I felt this story needed to be told. And of course, with music from Western Australia, Paris in the 1920s, you know, London during the Blitz, the West Country of England with Vaughan Williams narrating what would have been the soundtrack to her life. So that's how I conceived the entire concert. We did that as a chamber orchestra concert. And Fred O'Connor, who was her uncle, had written a beautiful West Aussie kind of folk song, which got arranged, and actually sung by Emma Lee Steer. And the Lee Steer's, great aunt was Kathleen O'Connor. So we have the West Australian farming family who's related to great aunt Kate, who have her paintings just hanging in their house, you know, unbelievable considering the work. You know, and these stories, you know, the thing about Australia is because of colonization is only the last 200 years. So the Western stories are still so fresh that we have living relatives of most people that have a story to tell since moving here. But look, we've done plenty of similar storytelling with our Indigenous friends. And, you know, that those magical moments of watching our musicians suddenly seeing that whilst they were trained in the silo I spoke about at the start of our conversation, and they perceive greatness to be executing Mahler under the baton of some great master in some pristine concert hall. You know, we've definitely taken the musicians on a journey where they now see the value of collaborating to tell these stories, of working with different art forms, of working with historical, cultural, indigenous stories. We did dim sum concerts as well, Sam, yeah, working with Chinese musicians and playing some of the most famous music from China, whilst eating a dim sum dinner in a very enormous Chinese restaurant. I mean, just we've had so much fun, I have to say.
It sounds amazing. Yeah, I like Meatballs, Mahler and Merlot. I thought that was one that I know I've got the order of that wrong, but it sounds wonderful. Really interesting to hear your observations just about, I guess, our relationship in Australia with classical music. I'm really interested in this idea because obviously we're in a very intense conversation at the moment about decolonization of Western art forms and how, what it means to have a heritage art form or a Western art form here in Australia, what our relationship with that and what's kind of appropriate. And I mean, it's a very complicated conversation that's going on, but you've observed Australian culture since 2000, taking that time to sort of create the vision for Perth Symphony Orchestra. What do you think our relationship with culture is like in Australia now? What's your observations around that, Bobby?
Look, on the whole, people are embarrassed. Like, you know, as I say, a huge reason for starting the orchestra is the words, "I wouldn't be seen dead in the concert hall." And so there's such a perception that it's part of a colonial past, that it's this art form that was kind of imposed on us with people trying to look back to, you know, Europe or Mother England or whatever it is, completely missing the point that great art is great art, and that to have access to extraordinary art from around the world is what helps us identify who we are and make sense of it. So, oh my God, I'm so passionate that every Australian should absolutely have access. And look, Bruce Peterson, who I met recently in Melbourne, he's the CEO of Grand Experiences. They create the, you know, Monet Alive and the Van Gogh Alive, you know, the immersive walkthrough art exhibitions, you know, and what he's done for visual art is unbelievable. Like, why would we not want to be able in our own city to walk in and see life-size Mona Lisas and extraordinary things that give us goosebumps, that make us think differently or feel differently? You know, so I absolutely believe that Western art has a place all over the world, but so does Australian. What is Australian art? And I don't think we've yet really understood what we're capable of doing because we focus so heavy on importing. And hence me going back to that whole, what we need to start producing and creating extraordinary concert music, theatrical, you know, dance experiences that are inherently drawing upon this melting pot of cultures that we call, you know, our history, which is absolutely indigenous, but also Italian and Chinese and all of the melting pot that Australia is so fabulous for. And then just going, and what can we say about that? Look at what a great country we are. And we are great because we're all these different cultures. That's what makes us us and has made us in some ways tolerant and laid back and easygoing because we've had to kind of, you know, mix and thrive and all the rest of it. But that does not mean that great art doesn't have a place in that to inspire us, that great music, as you said at the very start, is great music. I think now we just need to divert the energy that we're spending on arguing into creating. And creating extraordinary things that truly represent what Australia is at this point in time.
Hi, it's Sam. A quick interruption to this episode to ask if you've caught up with earlier episodes of Decoding Cultural Leadership. We release episodes every Monday at 8 a.m. Subscribe on your favourite platform so you can access new conversations hot off the press. Dive into our back catalogue to uncover a wealth of powerful conversations with some of the most dynamic thinkers, trailblazers and innovators in the cultural world. People like Michael Lynch.
It's been an incredibly lucky career in terms of some of the steps and even some of the missteps that I've taken.
Fiona Allen.
From early days, I wanted to be making a contribution.
Wesley Enoch.
What leadership is where you can actually stand by your values and keep talking in a persuasive way.
Louise Herron.
It's been wild, all-consuming, wild, massive, but brilliant. I've loved it. And so challenging and so ever-changing.
Claire Spencer.
How you hope that that institution will leave its fingerprints.
And Yarmila Alfonsetti.
It is a privilege to do what we do. It is an absolute privilege. And people had better be on their toes.
and keep connected for upcoming episodes featuring Richard Evans, Megan Burslem, Brian Ritchie, Greta Bradman, Nayara, and a host of other stellar guests. Subscribe now and embark on a journey of discovery, exploring new perspectives and deepening your appreciation for the arts and cultural leadership. Decoding Cultural Leadership, Culture, Society, Conversations. Presented in association with Limelight.
I like the way that you're taking a very positive approach and a very proactive approach, which is clearly, been the whole mission of your career, I would say, is to engage in such a positive way. And of course we get sort of mired in these kind of negative conversations. And I know, like recently people are talking about the traditions of the concert hall, what people wear and all these barriers and when to clap. And these are the sort of the cliche things that we come back to with classical music and thinking of them as kind of barriers to creating things like threshold anxiety. And you basically sort of threw all that out the window with PSO because you didn't worry about any of those rules or any of those kind of conventions of the concert hall, which are pretty much tied to something that was, from hundreds of years ago anyway.
I mean, the catchphrase for the orchestra is Perth Symphony, the orchestra that breaks the rules. And yeah, that's because I realized how many rules I put around me to make me feel that I was part of a world in which I wanted to belong. And, we went through so many moments early where musicians were like, well, I don't want to play that. And this is cringeworthy. And it's like, wow. How do we get rid of anything, the word cringeworthy for anything? Because, and I'm obviously not part of the orchestra and they've just announced that they're playing Taylor Swift. And you just know, that some people out there are going to go, the people that love orchestras, by the way, or, this symphonic classical crowd will just cringe.
Yeah.
Like, what? So we've got people cringing on both sides because you've got the people that are literally like, the orchestra's not my thing. I cringe at the thought of being in a symphony concert and telling my mates the next day I went to one, like, oh my God. And then you've got, so what does that tell us? It tells us that we put up a massive wall between those on board and those not on board and never shall that wall come down. And I'm like, no, there is no wall. If we're playing great music to people that want to hear it and we're lifting that and connecting them with, their mates and their time in which they live, and an orchestra can bring music to life on a scale that's totally unprecedented, then do it. Absolutely. But that doesn't remotely mean that Beethoven and Mahler are not exquisitely incredible, unbelievable works of art that should absolutely exist in perpetuity. There is just a place for everything. 100%. It was interesting, Sam, just to go back, you mentioned a little bit about within orchestras, and one of the biggest battles is internal. And there is this artistic tension with marketing and management. And that is because, of course, everyone in the artistic field feels that they are going to be judged. Like, you always want to be judged by your peers. If you're a footy player and a footy great says you're good, you respect that far more than if I've never been to a football game, but, oh, I think you're really good. I mean, that's nice, but we take stock from our industry and therefore being revered by our own industry. So unbelievably compelling and something we aspire to. And why wouldn't we? Any classical musician is like any other person. To be admired by your own greats is what you want. And of course, a lot of the time those greats would absolutely go, oh my God, Taylor Swift, lesser music in some way of some description. And so to be able to shift the mindset of musicians to go, no, just you keep playing out at the top of your game and perfecting that, but also consider how your gifts and your talent and your musicality can make so many more people than you already are feel incredible and serve a purpose to society. That's a really good thing. But we don't have those conversations enough within orchestras. I'm not saying that I did it well, but my God, I worked really hard with the musicians and the whole team and everyone to really say why every concert I get on stage before we start rehearsing, go, this is the reason this concert is taking place. It's not just we need to earn a fast buck, so we've decided to play some contemporary tunes. It's we see an opportunity to engage and do this. This is what's happening in the world right now with this artist. So George Michael, for example, we basically did a string orchestra concert of his music. That arose because the day that he passed away, I was asked, could a string quartet go into the studio to play an acoustic arrangement of a George Michael, which we did. And by lunchtime, 10,000 people had posted going, when are you going to play this?
Yeah.
And I'm people want to hear this. People actually literally want to come and hear a homage to a great artist played on this lush string sound. So we literally just arranged it completely for strings. This beautiful string version of George Michael, which to this day is one of my favorite. And we literally covered his life and shared his music and allowed people to grieve. And, but in the way that only our filmic sounding music can. So it was about sort of explaining to the orchestra, you are going to see several thousand people absolutely buzzing with joy and sadness and grief and emotion and everything because of what you're about to do. And so making sure that they were really connected to it as well, as opposed to, sorry guys, we're just taking a week off to do a bit of George Michael. We'll be back to the Mozart next week. You know, that was a huge journey, which I'm so proud of every musician that they, every single, you know, a huge majority of them now just go, I'm a gifted musician and I can change people's lives through all music. And I'm open to that now. So
that's incredible. And so you that sense of communication, making sure that they really understood what the vision was and the reason. So just talk me through some of the challenges, because you've gone from being, you know, a visionary founder to someone who's, you know, spent this time, you know, crafting and putting together everything to create this orchestra. And all of a sudden you're a CEO and you're responsible for, you know, and orchestra management is all about people and stakeholders and expectations and egos and balancing all that stuff that goes with it. What sort of challenges did you face and how did you navigate those challenges, Bawby?
Oh my gosh, have you got 4 days? we're talking about running a symphony orchestra here. we're talking about a symphony orchestra that didn't exist until I created it. So, you know, there were no systems and processes. I'd never run a company before. So even learning, trust me, working in a big company does not remotely give you the skills required to set up your own business, let alone one. I mean, the thing about symphony orchestras is they are inherently, if it's a professional symphony orchestra, they are going to be some of the best, most gifted, qualified people you're ever going to work with. So, you know, in any other setting, just imagine the most qualified PhD, neuro, astrophysicist, sciencey people you could lay your hands on. And then you've got hugely technical people. So all your production crew, lighting designers, audio, who are unbelievably technically minded, but also at the top of their game. Then you've got all of your administrators, volunteers, who are the people that, oh, just love to help your lovely orchestra. You've got such diverse teams. And this is actually where, to hark back to one of the very first things you said, I have a running background. And working with elite athletes who are very focused on a specific 4-year Olympic outcome, and the need that absolutely every single element of that team, whether it's the scientists on the shore, the coach in the boat, even their partners at home, cooking them food, the right nutrition, every element has to be right in order for that team to do brilliantly. So in order for our musicians to thrive, what has to go on behind the scenes, despite how diverse they all have to talk. And that's one thing that sport does really well. Mm. You've got the elite athlete, the coach, the nutritionist, the physiologist will be having regular conversations. What I've noticed in symphony orchestras are every time, no, I don't have to put this on the stage. I just do all the production. The musicians can just rock up later. And I'm generalizing because clearly there are some extraordinary orchestras out there, but
sure. The
communication and the collaboration and commitment between those different teams to going that the only thing that really matters is the music. And therefore we all have to crowd around that and the musicians so that on the night they feel like Ed Sheeran performing at Wembley Stadium and they feel like rock stars and they feel that they can absolutely do their best in every single seat. You know, that's been one of the biggest challenges and biggest learning curves is to manage those teams, respect and understand their expertise in so many different areas that I don't know. I'm like, I don't know anything about gensets. You're just going to have to talk me through this whole power thing. Why is that important? Why does the bins? I mean, the level of detail I had to understand being a small company, we at the height had 13 staff, 150 musicians and about 30 crew.
That's huge. You
know, so it sounds huge, but that's tiny for an orchestra. I mean, a lot of the big orchestras in Australia will have well over 30, 40 staff, let alone crew and then musicians. So, you know, I had to be across everything to make sure that everybody talked. And I think part of the success was that we did, that everyone had spoken to everyone. And so everyone was on the same page about the outcome. But also the communication happened in order to make that work.
So that yeah, then, I mean, it seems sort of obvious, really, is that communication is the essential thing, that everyone's committed to that same purpose. But sometimes it's difficult in a big organization. You sort of think everyone's on the same page. But I know when I worked in orchestras that I found that everyone was incredibly passionate about, you know, what the thing that they were doing in the orchestra, and the perspectives on everything were different. And then that's when things would sort of clash, because you'd have those tensions, because people were looking at exactly the thing that they needed to do, and they knew exactly how that worked, but they didn't necessarily, so that there wasn't that sense of communication necessarily all the time. So, you know, it's an interesting space, and
yeah, it sounds like, and you sort of addressed that. Systems and processes are absolutely key. Like, the yeah. one thing that you had to systemize and productize everything, going, we can't keep making the same mistakes twice. And also what happens is things are constantly evolving, particularly when you're working at speed. And if you've got 20 different versions of your run sheet, and someone's renamed something and you're naming protocols, and you're like, no, I thought that was the recent. Well, I updated that. Well, that was the recent. Well, hang on a minute. Which is now the, so what we ended up with, that you obviously have folders full of stuff to run an orchestra of everything, but we ended up running the orchestra on Excel, which means that for every concert, there was an Excel workbook, and the tabs in that workbook were the latest of everything. There was only one workbook, one version of the workbook, and whatever was in that production tab or that artist tab or the repertoire tab or the sponsors tab was that, you know, you could have whatever documents you liked elsewhere, but the finals went into that. So that was the point of truth. And by having one workbook, it meant that every person in the company could see all the tabs for all the different departments. And therefore there was this constant message of, we are a whole, you know, that the whole us and them, the musicians on the stage, and I won't say who, but I had a meeting with one symphony orchestra. And I'm like, so how many people have you got on your team? And they were like, oh, insert number. That was less than 50. And I'm like, how weird, because I thought you had at least 70 musicians on the payroll. And they're like, oh, sorry, yes, and the musicians. Right, so when you're thinking team, you're thinking obvious. And I'm like, just because the musicians aren't in the office, that they are still the most on salaried part of your team. Like, it was incredible. Just ordinary mindset. You know, and I can almost assure you, Sam, that quite a number of orchestral CEOs will think that way, because they see it as so distinct. I'm like, no. And this is part of what my new mission is that, because I understand high performing teams, but sport will build a team, but music builds a community. And within an orchestra, within an arts company, where you have these different departments who need to be high performing teams on their own, but they've all got to connect. And the one thing that connects a community is a shared purpose or a shared reason, a shared why. And so, you know, I found that going back to that every time, you know, and there was no day where running personally was easy.
Yeah.
There were plenty of days where it was unbelievable joy. Never one day. And I think I could have spent the rest of my life trying to work out how to do it well and right and make sure I did the right thing by everyone and all the rest of it. But I now know that creating a sense of community, that everyone felt important, from the volunteers, the tech people, that it wasn't just rock up, do your job, go away. Now the musicians get the applause. And the musicians are the only ones, let's face it, that get the standing ovation, and yet the whole team. And it was also educating the orchestra that the team, the orchestra need to think of the team as well, that they're worthy of an applause too, you know, that without them, they couldn't be there. So yeah, lots of fantastic leadership lessons you get from running a symphony, that's for sure.
Yes, I can imagine. It's relentless, because it's just every day's, you know, different challenges and things. And so we're moving forward to the fact that you decided then, you know, to make the difficult decision I'm assuming it was a difficult decision to walk away from this wonderful organization that you created, and essentially hand over the custodianship of it to someone else. And can you talk me through what your, you know, motivation was for moving on and what you wanted to achieve in this next chapter of your life?
Look, I always said that if I hadn't got it up and running within 10 years, then I don't think, and I particularly after 5 years, was like, I will not sustain this, as in to prop up I'm sure many of us know someone that's running a small arts company, and when the minute they leave, it's not going to keep going. It's run on their blood, sweat and tears, and thank God for those people. But it was a case of, I know that you just physically can't sustain that for more than 10 years. But I also realized it was going to take 10 years to change the mindset of an entire state into an orchestra, the thing you want to go see. So look, I'd always said 10 years. And so my burning desire was, how do I make this thing sustainable without me? I also think it's a huge risk. I mean, I love what Richard Tognetti does with ACO. And my God, what a staggering leadership and what a tenure. What a risk. And he'll know that. The board will know that. They will all know that.
Yeah.
But when you are so part of the brand, when you're Richard Branson at Virgin, can you take Richard Branson out of that company and retain its value? It's very hard. So, and it was never about me as well, Sam. That was the thing, that it wasn't, I want to build the Borby show and Borby's orchestra. It was, no, WA needs this orchestra. It needs a second orchestra to show people. And we have so many people now go to WASO, which I'm thrilled about. So, you know, we've done our purpose, but got to 10 years, COVID hit. Shocking time to leave. It was very unstable. We weren't even sure who was going to make it through COVID. So I thought, no, I cannot leave until I know this is going to go on without me.
Mm.
And thankfully COVID was good to WA, as in our borders shut and we became the hermit kingdom, and that's we right. flourished. Perth Symphony flourished because we could perform and no one else could, because everyone was waiting on international talent. And I'm so proudly parochial that everyone on stage is West Australian. So we crashed through and we became a stadium orchestra in COVID, and and our sponsors and donors and everyone were incredible standing by us. So at that point I just went, I can now see that there are some really big things that I have to change. I think in the last 4 to 5 years, Sam, I'd sat around so many tables with so many arts leaders going, we are worthy, we are valuable, this is what we contribute. And I'm like, we are talking to ourselves again.
Mm.
I needed to get out and start talking to the politicians and power brokers and CEOs of Australia. And I know that sounds awfully audacious and hairy, but I'm like, God damn it. We all need to do this. We all need to change the narrative in this country. We need to change the mindset of our major corporates, that the arts aren't just a nice thing to have and sprinkle some money in their direction, that this is fundamental to the identity and success of this nation going forward. And the cohesion of it, the vision of it, the power of Australia into the future will be defined by our culture and nothing else. Nothing else. People will want to come and live here and work here and drive the economic engine if Australia has that. Again, come back to that one vision. And we don't yet. And, you know, any country's identity, if you talk about France, you'll talk about, you know, croissants and Eiffel Towers and the Louvre. You literally talk about the art and culture of a country, the national costume, the dances, any nation you think of. So until Australia can talk about itself in that terms, we will not reach our full potential and not be as strong as we could be. So I then was like, yes, because I think even though saying goodbye was like sending my child off to university, knowing it's probably going to date people I don't approve of, it, you know, might do some things that I wouldn't do. And it might even never come home. That might be it. Might get married and go and live in another country. I was like, whatever happens, it's the right thing. That if it does that, then I've created an independent, brilliant, amazing arts company that other people can then shape and have a say in. And because my new vision, it wasn't until I really started finding my own new vision got stronger and stronger that then it became easy to leave, because I was excited about what I'm doing now. I want to get on and do it. I could see we've got brilliant people lined up to run the orchestra. So in the end, despite, you know, never feeling more nauseous than the day I was leaving.
Can imagine.
Yeah, it's the right thing.
Mm. Well, I mean, yeah, it seems to be in fantastic hands, because it continues to thrive. And I follow Perth Symphony Orchestra very closely. And Catherine is a wonderful CEO who's running it there now too. So with this new mission that you've got, Borby, this new work that you're doing, this evangelical, communication about the value and importance of culture to our national conversation, what does that look like? How are you delivering that? How are you executing that? And what sort of conversations are you having?
Oh gosh, so many. I don't think I've worked so hard for so little money since the first year of Perth Symphony. You know, it's amazing. You can go back to square one. But anyway, this time I have faith I can make it work. Look, I have a number of projects on the go. I'm trying to elevate my profile as a speaker, because if I meet with one person at a time, that's going to be a very slow turnaround. Whereas if I can talk to large groups of people about what I'm planning and how everyone can get involved and the benefits, economic, social, reputational, everything. So that's sort of one little corner of what I'm doing. Second thing is a big program called Arts at Work, and that's a working title, where my observation was that the government are never going to put in for the arts, because they, with all due respect, governments don't even run like companies, because as they shouldn't in a way, but they're lacking complete vision. Like, no one has yet to tell me what the vision for this country is. No prime minister has stood up there and declared what this nation could be in 50 years. And this is how we'll move towards it. And that is so missing. They're just government solve problems. And right now, they're never going to see that the arts, because the arts are a longer term solution. It's something that needs to be embedded and innate in our culture. So that's not a solution as well, is funding the arts. So what we need is big corporates to go, we can't exist without you being part of our modus operandi. So, and at the moment, corporates have designed their workplaces to be sport, not arts. And even our at school, it's you either do sport and or art, you don't do sport and art. So the narrative that I'm trying to change is that we need to be a nation of sport and art. And at the moment, most big companies, they have bike racks, showers, gyms, lunchtime netball, matchy-matchy, cycling jerseys. You know, the provision for their employees' physical well-being is quite extraordinary, but not one company has a practice room or an art studio. So in my discussions with CEOs, I'm like, so do you want staff to solve problems? Do you want them to be able to communicate with multiple cultures? Do you want them to express themselves clearly and meaningfully? Mm. Do you want them to be passionate about what they do? Do you want them to be able to, you know, see challenges in a new optimistic light? So if so, why is this focus on changing rooms and showers and bike racks and not on creativity and art? Because right now you have an entire workforce that probably has sung or played at some point in their life, and yet you've shut that off and told them there's no place for it in the workplace. So at the moment, we've just done a program with West Farmers, which has been so rewarding and so exciting. And it's a toe in the water. We've done a couple of workshops with the Department of Transport, and just seeing what companies shifting away to a creative, engaged, collaborative, artistic, cultural mindset can do an organization, which is, I think, potentially, Samuel, again, a game changer. So, you know, we'll just have to see how that evolves, but that's another project. Look, I'm working on both bringing amazing entertainment experiences that are really focused on the arts side, lots of symphonic stuff to Australia, but also creating amazing content here in Australia. Hence having meetings with people like Bruce at Grand Experiences to say, how can we meld visual oral storytelling on a grand scale that becomes something that we can export? So look, there's a number of things, very exciting things that I'm very passionate about going on at the moment, sucking my energy, like, and I'm still rowing. Can you believe that?
You're still rowing? Oh, wonderful.
4:40 a.m. alarm keeps going off, and I'm like, what am I doing? And I'm still playing. So look, I have a ridiculous life that's so rewarding and enriching. But, you know, I've given myself another 10-year goal of, can I shift the narrative of Australia that we are not just a grey, outdoorsy, laid-back, sporty nation, that we're a highly innovative, creative, imaginative, connected, inspirational, multicultural, and respectful of Indigenous cultural nation. And if I can shift the dial, you know, the thing is, you know, that if you can move it 1 degree here, in 50 years time, that you end up in a really, really different place. You're on a different trajectory. So I've just got to find out, how can I just nudge 1 degree? And if I do that, then at least I can go, I've contributed something meaningful. So.
Look, it sounds like you're on an incredibly powerful path there again, Bobby, to take that message that you've articulated so clearly and delivered through that wonderful organization, the Perth Symphony Orchestra. You've been really generous with your time. I just want to, leave on one point and get your thoughts around this, is just that intersection between cultural organizations. And you've talked a lot about, like, enrichment, culture enrichment and making the country, you know, a better place and a more vibrant place. What about those divisive issues of social change? Do you think, you know, orchestras, cultural organizations have a role to step in and articulate a position? We've seen, like, around The Voice recently, a lot of arts organizations banding together in a very positive way to communicate a message. But do you think they have a role to play in society more broadly, politically, like that?
Oh, hugely, hugely. And together we are stronger. And, you know, the hard thing is that if arts organizations were invested, and I use that word, invested in as other industries are, we would then have the capacity to bring about a much, much greater level of change. Like at the moment, every dollar is spent trying to get the 3-4 productions and, you know, 90-100 concerts a year happening. Look, for any societal change, for any social cohesion, it's got to be huge participation and encouragement and investment at grassroots level. And at the moment, what we don't have is the mid-tier, that we have people that start out in music and play in a school band or join a local choir. And then you've got a huge leap to the arts companies. What we haven't done is create a system. And look, this one's for 3 years' time, but creating something like AusKick, which is this incredible pathway where people participate, but you can see your way to the top as a footballer. And my feeling is that if arts companies are able to connect and inspire and bring people into their folds, that we absolutely need to keep doing the inspirational stuff. You know, without Olympic gold medalists and without an AFL grand final, you know, kids aren't glued to the telly wanting to grow up and be that. So we absolutely need to preserve the validity and, you know, amazingness of our top of the pile. But we've got to be able to filter that down and connect and pull people on the journey and engage communities and use us as a tool to transform society. But that bridge at the moment is the investment isn't there. It's impossible for arts companies to go beyond. And they're constantly put pressured to do this. You've got to do your education. You've got to do all this. And you've got to collaborate with each other. We want to see all of you guys work together. The time, if I'd had to collaborate with anyone on the George Michael show, it could never have happened. The time needed to even have a meeting.
Yeah.
With a company, they would have said, yeah, can you do next Tuesday fortnight? And I'd be like, well, the concert will be on sale by then. So evolve. You know, so it's just the arts companies are so under-resourced. Right, that our ability to transform is constantly handcuffed. But that doesn't mean that the potential isn't there to do all the things that you discussed. And I live in hope that it's not just hope. There is a solution. There is always, Sam, a solution. And we need the smartest minds in Australia to be on board with it. Hence saying the arts companies are going to keep doing now. Let's get the best commercial, business, economic and political minds involved in this challenge. Help us solve this, because every single industry will benefit tenfold, if not more.
It sounds like you've got a fantastic mission and a you know, challenging road ahead, but such an exciting vision, Bobby. And I think, you know, we watch this space. We're in to see some incredible changes on those spheres where you're going to be involved in influencing and contributing to. So thank you for your contributions. Now, people want to connect with you and to see your work or to see what you're doing in your current iteration, your speaking work, etc. What's the best place for them to find you?
So I do all my activities through my company, North Street Music. So northstreetmusic.com. I've got my own personal website. So bobbywebster.com. But I guess that the place where I kind of divulge and reveal everything is on LinkedIn these days. And again, very carefully chosen that as my, because LinkedIn is a more serious platform than something like, TikTok and Facebook. And I believe what I'm doing needs impact and is serious. So, I'd welcome anyone to follow me on LinkedIn, add a little message saying why and, you know, love to be connected to a far wider audience. So
brilliant. And yeah, you put some fantastic content up on LinkedIn too. I follow you regularly. So great. Wonderful to talk to you. Great to meet you. You know, I'd love to check in with you again, you know, at a later date. If you're very welcome to come back on the podcast and we can discuss, you know, where you're going with this wonderful mission. Thank you so much for your time today, Bobby. And I wish you all the very best. Thank you for joining us on Decoding Cultural Leadership.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me on this edition of Decoding Cultural Leadership. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please consider subscribing via your preferred platform so you never miss an episode. You can even write us a review. You can follow us on Instagram, X and Threads at DCLpod. That's at DCLpod. You can also write to me at sc@samuelcanduff.com. My huge thanks to creative director Niloufar Pashfarouche, and thanks to our production partners Limelight, Australia's dedicated music, arts and culture platform. Please head over to their website limelight-arts.com.au to read content related to this podcast. Decoding Cultural Leadership is recorded on the Wurundjeri, Gadigal and Palawa lands, and I acknowledge elders past and present and the immense privilege of hosting this conversation on lands where cultural leadership has been practiced for millennia before us. My name is Sam Canduff. This is a production of the Institute of Cultural Leadership, and we'll see you next time on Decoding Cultural Leadership.